You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Cleveland Indians. I am joined, as I am each and every week, by Jordan Bastian. JB, we had the Edwin Encarnacion press conference last week. It doubled as the Billy Joel press conference. Big day at Progressive Field, of course. What was your takeaway from the dual press conferences, aside from a autographed Billy Joel baseball, which you did not actually take away, but you had it in your possession at one time?
I did, and then I found a huge Billy Joel fan to pass it along to. You know, I would have preferred Eddie Vedder, you know, but I guess you can't go, you know, getting greedy now. No, you know what? It was thought it was a pretty eventful day at the ballpark. Obviously, it's pretty cool that, you know, the story you wrote about Larry Doby Jr. and his connection between Billy Joel's road crew and kind of helping bring that concert to Progressive Field. You know, that was really, really good stuff. Pretty unique connection there. And then obviously before that press conference was the Encarnacion show, which we have known for weeks was coming, but, you know, got to officially unveil him as a member of the tribe, and got to talk to Chris Antonetti and Mike Chernoff and Encarnacion's agent a little bit about that unique process, and also about where the Indians kind of go from here, which basically sounds like they're tapped out resource-wise, and they ended up with more resources than I think we thought they were going to have. So, you know, that was encouraging to see them kind of seize this moment, but now I think you're going to basically see them done in terms of anything that cost significant money. You know, if they want to address any other needs like the outfield, you know, probably going to have to come via the trade route or just solving it through the puzzle pieces that they have internally.
Yeah, tapped out about sums it up from you know, talking to people and digging in this a little more. Now that it is official, you do get the idea of they're really extending themselves here in a major way financially, which you knew, of course, but to get the specifics and, you know, the World Series windfall that was reported in some places, I think was a bit exaggerated, to say the least. You know, they were third worst in attendance last year, so and their payroll's jumping up. It actually was going to jump up substantially if they did absolutely nothing this winter. It was going to jump up about $20, $22 million just from in-house raises and having Andrew Miller for a full season. And then you throw Encarnacion on top of the pile. They're going up from about what they were the mid-80s on opening day last year, mid-$80 million range, and now they're going to be around $130 million. So that's a substantial jump for a club that's just had struggles to put butts in the seats over the years. So big test of faith in this roster and in this fan base.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, they've always said, as we've talked about many times, that when it was the right moment, when it was opportunistic, you know, they would, you know, be willing, more willing to break free from sort of their modus operandi and, you know, look at ways to take advantage of a situation. And right now, you look at the landscape of the division, you know, Paul Dolan can look at that and say, you know, not only do we have a team here that's capable of contending, I mean, the landscape is really set up for the Indians to be the power in the American League Central for next year and perhaps the next few years with the way some of those other teams are transitioning. So on top of that, you see a roster that reached Game 7 of the World Series and pushed the Cubs to extra innings with a decimated roster at the time. So they know that their moment right now it's a great moment for trying to capitalize on what they have in place, sort of the way some of the contracts are lined up and controllable for the next few years, keeping that core intact and, you know, being a team that should be able to sustain this run for several years. And so when you have all those things lined up and you have a lower draft pick and, you know, a chance to add a premier slugger who fits exactly what you need, you know, you have a little more revenue to help out and, you know, attendance bumping up a tad bit, which is still critical to this franchise and they need to continue to do it. You know, I think it's going to be, you know, obviously that's what helps convince the owner to spend a little more than they were comfortable with. I thought it was interesting, Chernoff, Antonetti, all of them, even the, you know, agent, they all came out and said they did not expect that the Indians would have these resources available when the offseason began. So I think that's an important point that, you know, I don't think that's just them blowing smoke. I think that's them legitimately thinking when this offseason began, they weren't going to be a player for a guy like Encarnacion. And, you know, things obviously changed. I think the fans are thrilled to see that.
Yeah, and even if they get to 2 million in attendance, which they haven't done since 2008, I think they will do. But you know, even that, they're kind of taking a bath here, short of a deep postseason run. So really banking on that. So it'll be fascinating. A lot of pressure on this club, and good pressure, because you're right. The AL Central is wide open, and then I think it'll be a matter of, you know, do they stay healthy and do guys live up to the terms? And on that note, you know, you were kind enough to point people to my Larry Doby Jr. piece. I want to point people to your piece on Encarnacion and kind of the aging curve here. He's entering age 34 season, and you took a look at some guys in this century, in the 2000s, who had similar offensive profiles in the years leading up to their age 34 season, and kind of how they fared the next 3 years moving forward, since Encarnacion's deal is, of course, three guaranteed years. What'd you find out?
Yeah, mixed bag. That's what I found out. The one fun fact that was really encouraging was, so what I did was I took guys for their age 30 to 33 seasons, so it's kind of a significant sample, and I went with fewer than 400 strikeouts and higher than 120 homers. So 30 homers a year with a good command of the strike zone, which is what they were citing for Edwin's, you know, their belief that Edwin will not age poorly. The fun fact that was in there was Albert Bell popped up with the exact same slugging percentage. The not so fun fact was Albert Bell didn't play after that because of his hip issues.
Right.
But there's, you know, Gary Sheffield was in there and he aged really well. You had a guy like Carlos Lee who popped up who aged horribly after that. So it's kind of a mixed bag. I think generally speaking, the production dipped across the board, but still to a point for the most part where you're still getting sound production. You know, I think that's the drastic difference between a guy like Encarnacion and a guy like Napoli, where, you know, the strikeout rate is basically, you know, for Edwin than what it is for Napoli. So it's not that feast or famine slugger. It's a little more consistency. So if the power does drop a little bit, you're not dropping the power and getting a ton of strikeouts. Maybe it's some of those homers are doubles, you know, and I think that's kind of the hope as he ages here. So it was interesting to see the mix of names that were in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, you're right. I mean, Napoli, the bulk of his home runs came at home, and they certainly came in bunches. So Encarnacion has been known to spread the love out a little more even distribution over the course of the six-month season. And I think to when the Tigers gave Miguel Cabrera that mammoth extension a couple years back, it's one thing Dave Dombrowski said was, you know, the hit tool and how it'll age well. And Encarnacion isn't Cabrera, don't get me wrong, but that's kind of what you're banking on, especially in a three-year sample. It's a little safer, of course, than what the Tigers did with Cabrera. So we'll see. But again, it's going to come down to health and health of the starting five and how that all, if the ball bounces their way, pretty much. They got a lot riding on it bouncing their way in 2017. So obviously we said they're pretty tapped financially, probably not expecting much, if anything, in the major league contract realm. I'm sure we'll see some minor league deals here between now and spring training. But give me a bold prediction leading up to the 2017 regular season. Give me a bold prediction for the Tribe.
Yeah, so, you know, across MLB.com, we're kind of making some of these picks. And, you know, rather than look at a transaction before the spring training begins, you know, I looked more at, you know, what would be a bold prediction for the opening day roster. And I went with Brad Zimmer, you know, opening the season with the Indians. You know, he's a highly touted prospect, and he could be knocking on the door this year. Now, to be clear, I don't think it's going to happen, but there's precedent. We saw just 1 year ago as the situation with Brantley lingered and opportunity arose, we saw Tyler Naquin seize that chance with an awesome spring. You know, when spring training began, none of us were really writing him in as a realistic candidate, and he ended up being their, you know, regular center fielder and a Rookie of the Year candidate at season's end. So there is some precedent. You know, if Brantley's situation again lingers and looks a little worse than the Indians or everyone else is expecting, and opportunities there and the Indians can't really go out and afford somebody, you know, maybe that is a chance for a guy like Brad Zimmer, or, you know, more realistically, maybe a guy like Yandy Diaz to vie for extra at-bats and playing time. I think the one thing when you look at Zimmer is it's pretty clear there's development left for him. His strikeout rate really spiked in AAA when he got his first taste of that level last year. His OPS was significantly lower than what he did the rest of his minor league career, but they were internally kind of encouraged by some of those failures allowed him to recognize things he needs to do to be successful in the majors. So they're pretty, you know, it's almost sometimes with a high prospect, a blessing in disguise when they go through a period like that, because it'll help open their eyes to just, instead of getting by on raw talent and ability, learning how to make that adjustment. So I think that's going to be important going into 2017. That's probably why he's going to open at AAA. But, hey, you never know.
You never know. Yeah, hopefully we don't have another Brantley setback and another guy getting popped for PEDs like last year, because that's what it took to open the door for Naquin, and certainly don't want to see that again. But, yeah, Zimmer's coming, and strike zone discipline will be an area of emphasis for him moving forward. Until then, I want to thank Jordan Basham for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. This is our latest look at the Chicago White Sox, and I am joined by Scott Merkin. And, Merk, you're out in Glendale, Arizona, beautiful Glendale, Arizona. Have you reported to spring training camp a month and a half early? What's going on out there, Merk?
Yeah, it's not like I won't get enough of this wonderful city and area during spring training, with it being a little longer this year, thanks to the World Baseball Classic. But I'm here for the White Sox hitters mini camp. Number of top prospects here. Kind of, they do it every year. And Yoan Moncada is here. Zach Collins is here. Charlie Tilson, who was acquired for Zach Duke last year and then had the freak injury in his first, I don't even think he made it through a first game. He got about five and a half innings in and tore his hamstring going for a fly ball in center. He's here. Courtney Hawkins, former number one draft pick, is here. So, you know, a lot of good players to see, and I'll be out there for a couple days and filing some reports and hopefully some video reports and everything else. So it's a good look at some of the young guys, although, you know, a lot of the young guys they acquired in those first two trades for Chris Sale and Adam Eaton were mainly pitchers, but Moncada and Basabe were the two position players. And from what I know, Basabe is not at the mini camp. So it'll be interesting to see just, you know, I think it's pretty basic and straightforward, but a good look at some of the younger guys before we see them starting Valentine's Day.
Yeah, and you'll be buddy-buddy with Moncada by the end of this week. You guys will be swapping stories about Eagles concerts, I'm sure, so that'll be good.
He's got to know them.
We still got some time, though, of course, before everybody reports to Glendale. And we're asking all of our reporters this week for their bold prediction on the teams they cover. Give me a bold prediction for the White Sox between now and spring training.
Well, with all the rumors, with more talk about this guy being traded than me tweeting about Michigan football, I'm not sure how bold it is, but I believe Jose Quintana will be traded before the start of spring training. And, you know, it's kind of weird, Anthony. I know, you know, you've done the beat thing, too, and it's kind of strange to speculate on a guy's livelihood. But in this case, I think it's a good thing either way for Quintana. If he stays, you know, he's going to be the ace of that staff. He's going to be the opening day starter, assuming he stays through all of spring training. And if he goes, it almost certainly means he's going to a team that's contending, I guess, unless the Atlanta Braves sneak up and make a big, you know, offer for him. And even then, Atlanta, you know, is probably believed to be not too far off. So I think it's a good thing either way. And I know there's been constant rumors about Pittsburgh and Houston and the Yankees and everyone else. And I think the Sox demand is extremely high. It should be extremely high, and they should not budge in that. They didn't in Sale, and they didn't with Eaton, just because of Quintana's great ability, his great temperament, and his great contract altogether. But I really do believe, and I'm not sure if you agree on this or not, we'll see in a second, but that one of these teams who probably is balking maybe on the, you know, maybe one of the top two guys or maybe adding the fourth guy in, is going to eventually move on this, because, you know, he's the kind of guy who can put a team over the top. Maybe not as electric as Chris Sale is on the mound, but certainly, you know, the model of consistency.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think something will come down. I mean, even if he's not traded, he's going to be a fascinating, intriguing player for 2017, just because there'll still be a lot of attention on him throughout the first half, because he'll still be a trade candidate for the home stretch. So a guy who's consistently been labeled Mr. Underrated, you know, he's going to have a lot more eyes upon him in 2017, one way or another, where he's pitching for a contender or pitching to perhaps be a midseason trade chip. But I think you hit on, I mean, the Astros probably have the most incentives, just as a team that's already made some big moves for 2017, could still stand to shore of their rotation. I keep wondering if the Rockies...
I think Pittsburgh would jump in there too, though, right? Because Pittsburgh, I realize, you know, the defending world champion is in that division, and they certainly haven't gotten any worse, and St. Louis is a solid team. But, yeah, I think Pittsburgh believes this is their window now too, right? So I don't think they're going to, you know, I know they want to hang on to some of their... we talked about this last week on the podcast, that you know, prospects are such a huge commodity right now. So I'm not sure, you know, who they want to give up, if that includes a Meadows or a Glasnow, who I know the Sox have had their eye on for a long time. But I think eventually you got to decide, you know, can we move, you know, Mike Rizzo, one name I was thinking of, made a good comment at the winter meetings where he said, you know, it's not how many you trade, but who you trade. And they kind of felt like the moves they made came from positions of depth, so they were able to do that. We'll see how that plays out, you know, in the Adam Eaton trade. But it'll be interesting to see if Pittsburgh jumps in there too. But I think you're right. Houston would be the favorite right now.
Yeah, the problem for me with Pittsburgh is just the division they're in, and you're chasing the Cubs. Right. And as much as they do believe in their product in general, you know, to really swing a big trade like that and a team that's valued its prospect up, and for good reason, in that market for a long time, to go all in on Quintana would be a pretty bold bid when that's what you're up against. But, you know, I keep saying this. It's a dark horse, but I wonder if the Rockies are prominently involved or get prominently involved, because they certainly have some nice prospect pieces, and that's a team that's really gone. You know, the Ian Desmond signing was a big move forward for them. No matter how you feel about it, it was certainly a sign that they believe heavily in 2017. So obviously always looking for an ace in Colorado. But Jose Quintana will, of course, be a subject of fascination moving forward. Less of a source of fascination, but still interesting all the same. Giovanni Soto, what are the chances of him occupying a good deal of time behind the plate in 2017?
Well, I think he will make the team, you know, almost certainly out of spring training. But I don't think it's going to be a starter's job. I think it's going to be a pretty, you know, even split. Well, I don't think you can do an even split with five starters, but you know what I'm saying. With Omar Narvaez, you know, so I think that's the kind of catcher they were looking for. I had heard some people say, you know, oh, they should get Matt Wieters for a year and that kind of thing and see how he can handle the staff. You know, I think they were looking at a guy just like Soto to kind of fill the gap. Narvaez maybe gets a couple starts a week, Soto gets three, or the other way around, and you can balance it out. Well, they know him from a couple years ago when he was with when he was working behind the plate with the White Sox. So, you know, I think it's an interesting move. Of course, the most interesting move is they could have both Giovanni Sotos on the opening day roster, both the left-handed pitcher and the catcher, although the left-handed pitcher spells his first name differently, I believe.
Right.
But it's a good little pickup. You know, I mean, they like Narvaez. I think they like Kevin Smith still. He's at this hitter's mini camp, as a matter of fact. And it'll be interesting to see the battle. But, you know, depth is key. They really did not have much depth at the catcher's position, something they needed.
Another depth move, sounds like Everett Cabrera signing a minor league deal with the White Sox. This guy hasn't been in the big league since 2015, but potential middle infield depth there.
Yeah, again, you know, I mean, the Sox seem to have thrived in the past on picking up other teams' kind of one-time all-star or highly touted prospect and giving them kind of a second chance, and that would be Cabrera. You know, good speed, little versatility. So, again, just kind of depth. At bats, you know, as we've joked about a number of times, they're going to field a team in 2017. Everyone is so excited about the prospects that should arrive in 18 or 19, but, you know, there's going to be baseball before then, so they need, and they have plenty of spots, you know, really filled out there, you know, with, you know, Abreu at first and a good mix at second and Saladino and Sanchez and Laurie and Anderson at short, Frazier at third. But again, you have other options if some of these guys eventually do get traded as well. And, you know, I should mention one more thing on the catcher spot is, obviously, the big thing on the catching is Zach Collins, you know, who is here at the mini camp, and as of right now, he is the man they're viewing as their catcher of the future. But that future probably is not until, you know, 18, maybe even 19. So in the interim, you got to have guys who can take the at bats, and that's some of the signings you're seeing from the White Sox in the last week or so. Just kind of, I don't want to diminish it, but just kind of, you know, guys who can go up there and play during the 17 season.
Yeah, maybe Willie Garcia will get a few at-bats in there as another guy. Another move.
Another guy, yes.
Since we last spoke, Merck. I guess Willie Garcia.
Kobayashi, I believe, too, is another guy they added via minor league deal, too. So, you know, their 40-man is at 40 right now. So I guess it depends on, you know, some of the moves they make in the future in terms of trades and some of the other guys they might move off the roster. So right now their 40-man is full, though.
I know you had a conversation recently with Zach Putnam for a story on the website. This guy had a 2.30 ERA in 27 and third innings last year before surgery to remove bone spurs. But what were your takeaway from that conversation?
You know, that he's had no setbacks in his rehab. He's throwing from 120 feet right now. He wants to get off the mound a couple of times. I'm not sure if you read into the article there, Anthony, but Zach Putnam lives in Ann Arbor in the off season, which is, you know, pretty much the Holy Land. And he's hoping to get a cut a couple times off the mound in Ann Arbor there before spring training. But, you know, I think they'll take it slow with him in spring training because of the fact that it's longer this year, first of all. And he stressed this a couple times to me is, you know, April is his target. He doesn't need to be at 100% on February 17th or March 12th. He just needs to be ready when the season starts. And he's a valuable guy, and I'm not sure what the trade value would be in the future if they're even looking at that. But we saw in the, you know, postseason how relievers have kind of expanded past just the guy in the eighth and just the guy in the ninth, you know, thanks to Andrew Miller and even Aroldis Chapman a little bit in the World Series. So, you know, Putnam, I'm not saying, you know, they're on the same level. Obviously, Miller's got a little, you know, better resume, but Putnam, Petrushka, Dan Jennings, all guys who could conceivably give you, you know, come in the fifth inning if you need it and pitch the fifth and sixth and kind of bridge you, keep you in the game, or pitch the sixth and seventh to get you to late inning relief. So he knows the value. He watched the postseason. And, you know, the key thing with him, though, is he's getting healthy because he put up decent numbers in short work last year, and that was not at 100%. That was trying to pitch through the pain. And he said, you know, he had this surgery before. I believe it was 2013. He said this one was a little more invasive where they actually, you know, the first one was arthroscopic, so this one they had to actually cut. So, you know, he's taking his time, working his way back, but doing well and getting close to where he needs to be.
All right, that's the latest from Scott Merkin. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Chicago White Sox edition. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Detroit Tigers. I'm joined, as I am each week, by Jason Beck. Beck, this week on MLB.com, all of our beat writers, yourself included, are submitting their bold predictions for the remainder of the winter. It's obviously been a very quiet offseason from the Tigers' perspective, so give me a bold prediction between now and day one in Lakeland, Florida.
Well, I mean, it's not much, but, you know, I think there's a there's a chance for a match between the Tigers and Austin Jackson on the reunion, which, you know, I'm sure isn't going to generate a whole lot of buzz outside Detroit, but which would interest Tigers fans. I mean, the setup's there. You know, they need at least a stopgap center fielder until their prospects are ready. Jackson needs a place for kind of a career rebound after losing most of last season to a torn meniscus. I think there's a chance here. As of late last week, there was nothing serious going on, but as we know in baseball, things can change as you get to this point in January and spring training gets closer and teams start having to make decisions and so do players.
Yeah, Beck, let's run through the center field options. Beyond Jackson, I mean, he's an obvious one. We've discussed that quite a bit on this podcast. You know, throughout this winter, it's kind of seemed like a good fit for a team, you know, looking for a budget-friendly move. But as it stands right now, Jacoby Jones, Tyler Collins, Anthony Ghost. That's the center field depth chart pretty much. And with Jones, you know, highly touted prospect, a prospect of maybe long-term viability there, but 12 strikeouts and 28 at-bats at the end of 2016. What's the read on Jacoby Jones' readiness at this point?
Well, I think those stats show really what was going on at Triple-A for most of the year, too, that there's a high strikeout rate. They really would like to see him improve on that rate of contact. They think he could use some more time down there. But if push comes to shove, they might not have a whole lot of choice. Or if he makes an impressive spring training and really makes his case, it's going to be hard to keep him down. Athleticism is in abundance with him. It kind of reminds me of Brandon Inge more than a decade ago when he was first trying to find an alternate position from after moving out from catcher when the Tigers signed Pudge Rodriguez. You know, they had looked at Inge at center field, and if they hadn't brought back Alex Sanchez at the time, or if they had signed, you know, big-time free agent third baseman during that offseason after the 04 season, which they were trying to do, Inge might very well have ended up being a major league center fielder. I think there's a lot of similarities in Jones is that he's very athletic despite being not slight in size. He's got a power bat. There's a little bit of feast or famine in his hitting style. But you can see him fitting in a lot of different places. And right now, just the way the Tigers system works out, really what the Tigers' needs are at the major league level, center field is the most logical place at this point. So he really has a fit there. It's just a question of whether he can sit there and hold his own now or whether it'd be best to wait until midseason or maybe even give him closer to the full season down in Toledo.
Where do things stand with Ghost? Obviously, he got into a scrap with Lloyd McClendon in AAA last year, and McClendon is now on the big league staff as hitting coach, returned to the Tigers. So what's the situation there with Ghost?
They say it's water under the bridge, as Brad Ausmus put it. It remains to be seen. You don't usually hear of run-ins like that between players and managers at the AAA level. It was really surprising when it happened, and it really says something that it was serious enough that they moved Ghost down to AA to finish out the year, and he didn't even come back. They're going to have to rectify that, because McClendon's a hitting coach, and he's really going to have a crucial role on this team if it's going to have success. We talked about it last week, the challenges he faces in trying to get more consistency out of this lineup and out of the hitters. The veteran hitters who've worked with him before like him a lot, so I don't think he's going anywhere. It's going to be up to Ghost to kind of mend this and make his case to get his old job back. He didn't hit well last year. He really hasn't shown any signs of hitting consistently, but he's also a guy who, you at least would hope that with more and more time, he can get a little bit more confidence in himself and feel like he knows who he is as a hitter. I'm not sure I know who he is as a hitter, but maybe somebody else does. We'll see. He certainly has the speed and athleticism to make it work in center field, but he's got to put it together to match baseball skills.
Elsewhere in the free agent spectrum, we talked about Austin Jackson, of course, but Coco Crisp, Desmond Jennings, Colby Rasmus is an intriguing bounce-back candidate. I don't know if he'll be in the Tigers' price range when all is said and done. Peter Borges, Michael Bourne had a strong finish to 2016 in Baltimore. Any of those names stand out?
Desmond Jennings is right around that age range and right at that point in his career where you wonder if there's a setup for a rebound in him. He's also a Boris client, I believe, as is Michael Bourne, or at least he was. So those aren't necessarily automatic cheap options there. Certainly Rasmus, you wonder, given the production he was able to provide despite the struggles, whether he would be somebody to commit for $2 million or less. It might be a little bit of a surprise if he does. Coco Crisp, he was a good center fielder once upon a time. Age has kind of taken some of the energy out of his legs, as you would expect for somebody heading into their late 30s, but he's certainly somebody who has the know-how. Peter Borges, if you look at center field at Comerica Park as the type of position and the type of surroundings that require an abundance of speed combined with some instincts, then he might have the best skill set for the role. But the question with him has always been hitting and whether he can hit enough to stay up there. Is there enough of a potential in him at this point in his career to really believe that he could do something more than what a Jennings or some of these other guys could give you, or even Austin Jackson, going back to before. There's certainly a lot of options. No surefire ones there, though. At least with Austin Jackson, there's a familiarity factor, and he's a positive presence in the clubhouse. I think his clubhouse presence was underrated for the time he was here.
All right, there you have it, the latest from Jason Beck, and I'm sure the Tigers will do something in center field between now and the start of camp, or at least within camp. And Beck's picking Austin Jackson as his pick the click. We'll see what happens. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers edition. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Kansas City Royals. I'm joined, as I am each week, by Jeffrey Flanagan. And I mean it. We do this every week, Jeffrey, and the last few weeks, pretty bare bones. We haven't had much to work with outside of, further breaking down the Wade Davis for Jorge Soler swap. But We got a lot of activity from the Royals in this last week. A lot of stuff to dig into here. Let's start with the Jerod Dyson trade. Jerod Dyson for Nate Karns. Karns comes back from Seattle. Now, he had a 5.15 ERA in 22 games, including 15 starts last year. He did strike out 101 guys in 94 and one-third innings, and importantly, under control through 2020. I think that's the big issue there. Dyson, of course, just had 1 year left before eligible for free agency, so break down this trade for us.
Yeah, it's a curious trade. The Royals definitely there's some economics to it. Dyce is a guy who would get about $2.5 million in arbitration this year. Karns is pre-arb eligible, so he's a minimum guy, so they probably save another $2 million there. Combined with the Wade Davis trade, they've knocked about $9 million off the payroll. So now that's estimated somewhere around 136. I think that's in their comfort zone. And even to the point they might be able to add a, you know, bargain basement, low-level starter or reliever going forward. Dyce, as you know, kind of got squeezed out of the outfield rotation once they got Jorge Soler. He was going to be back to a fourth or fifth outfielder. They've got plenty of depth in the outfield. They've still got Paulo Orlando. They've got Terrence Gore. They've got Billy Burns. They've got a couple prospects and Hunter Dozier and Jorge Bonifacio that they like. So that was an area of depth. And you mentioned, you know, Dyce is in his last year. So of the seven pending free agents, they've now traded two of them and got a decent return. You know, we don't know that much about Karns' possibilities going forward. He's obviously that power right arm. You know, he sits in the mid-90s and can touch 98. Has intrigued not just the Royals, but, you know, intrigued the Mariners at one point, intrigued the Rays at one point, drafted by the Nationals. So for a kid who's just had a couple of big years experience, he's had a lot of interest, and it's because of that power arm. And I think they just feel like Dave Island, their pitching coach, can, you know, tweak some mechanics and get something out of him as a possible fifth starter or a possible bullpen addition.
Yeah, Dave Island certainly untapped potential before, and Karns does have potential. There's no doubt about it. And, again, the contractual control is a huge element here for a team. It is trying to get more cost-effective for the long haul, so it makes sense from that perspective. But, Jeffrey, you know, for the 2014 and 2015 runs, Dyson was about as important as a quote-unquote role player or part-timer can be. What's kind of maybe legacy is too lofty a word, but what's his legacy there in Kansas City?
Yeah, he really made some big plays in those postseason runs. You know, I remember him throwing out a guy at third base in the Angels series going back to 2014, which at the time was a huge play. He stepped in for Alex Gordon when Gordon got hurt and held down the fort at left field. Terrific defender. People don't really appreciate his arm strength. I always thought he had the best arm in the Royals outfield, bar none. So he certainly struggled at times offensively, but he was a speed guy. He fit their profile. Good defense, good speed, stole 30 or more bases several times. And he's going to be missed. I mean, just judging from the Twitter reaction, fans here in Kansas City really loved him, and they're going to miss him. Of course, we know how fickle that can be, because when I remember writing 2 years ago at the winter meetings that the Royals had intended to give him a chance at the starting job, and Twitter was an uproar going, oh, my God, how can you give a guy who can't hit, you know, 500 ABs? So, you know, how that world works. It just flips in a second. So the guy they didn't like before, they really missed now that he's gone.
Yeah, public perception can always change in a hurry. But, Dyson was a terrific personality for that club, just being around the Royals quite a bit, especially during those postseason runs. He was always one of the more quotable guys, which is
yes, he was.
Perspective, and just kind of fit the profile of that club, the energy and the speed element, of course. So he'll definitely be missed, but maybe they got a good one back in Karns. There was another trade last week, a much more minor trade. In fact, it involved minor leaguers. Peter O'Brien acquired for Sam Lewis. We know, though, the Royals, you know, on that search for right-handed power, maybe O'Brien qualifies.
Yeah, he doesn't really fit what you would think is the profile of a Royals player. He's not particularly athletic, not a good defender. But, again, there's that power potential that they're looking at. He only has, I think, 79 Major League PAs, so it's kind of a mystery. But if nothing else, you know, Dayton explained to me, it's organizational depth. I still think at this point, they probably go in the season with a floating DH, but We'll get into that a little bit later about potential full-time guys. And he certainly will compete for that job, but to me, it'd be kind of hard for a guy with that little experience to just step in and surprise and win the DH job full-time, because also then you've got to wonder what you do with Chester Cuthbert, who's out of options. But obviously, big-time power, and a lot of teams have been intrigued by that too, just like Nathan Carnes. So that's why these guys keep getting opportunities.
And some opportunities in Major League Camp for some guys invited to take part. Some names you'll probably recognize: Jonathan Sanchez, Al Albuquerque, Brandon League, Bobby Parnell, Chris Withrow. All these guys get spring training invites. And Jeffrey, this is the definition of throwing spaghetti at the wall, is it not?
What Dayton does every in his scouting staff every single year. I mean, they go out and they sign a bunch of these guys who've been out of baseball for 2 years or been pitching in the Dominican or whatever, and they've totally off your radar. I had to really research, like Brandon League, where has he been? Albuquerque, where has he been? And Purnell, where has he been? I knew about Sanchez. I wrote a little thing about him a couple weeks ago. But, again, if one or two of those guys break through, they look like geniuses again, like they did with Ryan Madsen and others. So that's what you do in a small market situation. You scout these guys, and they have a terrific scouting department led by Gene Watson. And they will uncover these guys. And who knows, even like last year, Chin Ming Wong gave them a pretty serviceable year for a guy who was off everybody's radar, too. So they do need help in the bullpen. If they're lucky, one or two of these guys sticks. And like you say, spaghetti against the wall, maybe a couple of noodles stick there.
All right, you alluded to the DH situation conversation. There's still a bit more than a month remaining until pitchers and catchers report in Surprise, Arizona. Give me a bold prediction, Jeffrey, for the rest of the offseason here from the Royals' perspective.
Well, I wrote about this that's going to come out this week, and in one possible bold prediction, and don't hold a gun to my head about this at all, but they have had a few kick-the-tire conversations about Matt Adams in St. Louis, and, another guy who doesn't necessarily fit their profile. He's not athletic, but he's a guy who's got tremendous power from the left side. I think they'd prefer it to be from the right side, to be honest, but they have discussed those. Possibly acquiring him, at least that's what the reports have been. The Royals have not confirmed that. But, hey, if you get a guy like that, you'd have to figure out something to do with Chester Cuthbert, who's out of options, and right now would be the number one DH choice along with the rest of the committee. But that's a guy who hit 16 homers last year. He certainly, no ballpark is too big for him, so at Kauffman Stadium wouldn't intimidate him. The problem is who would you give up in return? I know the Cardinals were very interested in Jerod Dyson. Well, now he's not available. So the only other option would be a guy like Lorenzo Cain. Now, that's a pretty big difference in swapping salary. So one makes $11 million, one's going to make about $2.8 million. So that would probably be balanced out a little bit. And also, you were talking about the great depth the Royals have right now. That would certainly reduce that depth to get rid of an all-star center fielder, and would also kind of go against their plan, which is to compete for a title in 2017. But, they're trying to get better. They do have, like I said, they do have some depth in the outfield. It wouldn't be totally shocking, but it's certainly a name that would be intriguing.
All right, there you have it, the latest from Jeffrey Flanagan. I'm glad we had stuff to talk about this week, Jeffrey. That helped a lot. Maybe make a couple more trades this week, Dayton Moore, and keep these podcasts fresh and hopping. We like that.
There you go.
All right, we'll check in with Jeffrey again next week. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals edition. Hey, everyone, thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Cashman, and this is our latest look at the Minnesota Twins. I'm joined by Rhett Bollinger. And, Rhett, let's kick it off here. We've got a little bit about a month, a little more than a month to go before guys report to Fort Myers, Florida. So give me a bold prediction for the rest of the Twins offseason.
Well, I don't know if it's too bold at this point, but I think at this point, gone long enough in the offseason, I don't think that Brian Dozier will be traded. I think if anything, they're going to build the offense around him. I could actually see the Twins signing another player to kind of maybe complement the offense, maybe sign an outfielder. Obviously, they have a very young outfield with Byron Buxton, with Eddie Rosario, with Max Kepler. A veteran bat could certainly help this team a lot. We know they need pitching, which is not very bold to say they need pitching. Obviously, last year had the worst ERA in the majors. So I think it would be very bold if they sign an outfielder. I know they've talked to Jose Bautista's representative this offseason. I don't think it's too serious. At least checking in to see there's his availability out there, especially considering the fact that it sounds like Batista could maybe take a one-year deal. So I think the Twins will hang on to Dozier, try to build around him the rest of the way here going forward.
The Twins do have that protected first-round pick, so you never rule out sometimes those are opportunities to get in the market of a guy you know, when his market does crumble, but we shall see. Obviously, Rhett Dozier has been the centerpiece of any and all news regarding the Twins these last few weeks. Really, this whole winter, we've been talking about the possibility of Dozier being on the move. But, you know, to your point earlier about it kind of gets to the heart of if this is going to happen, maybe it would have happened by now. This thing is really dragged out. It seems we've heard reports in the last week or so that the Twins are close to making up their minds. What's the latest you hear there?
I think at this point, this week, it should be resolved. I think the Twins do want to kind of get this done with. We had talked about it the entire offseason. It's been kind of dragging throughout. We do know, obviously, that Jose De Leon is kind of the main target of the Twins, the right-handed pitcher, big pitching prospect for the Dodgers. But kind of the pieces around that's kind of what they've been kind of haggling over, it sounds like, whether or not the Dodgers are willing to get rid of other, not, or sorry, to include other top prospects for Dozier. So far at this point, they obviously have not because they haven't had a trade yet. So, I think the Twins are probably smart to set a deadline and say, hey, you know, if you're not going to make this deal, then we're just going to kind of move on with Dozier into the second baseman because they can't sit here and wait forever. Obviously, other teams in the mix as well. We've heard teams like the Braves in that mix, you know, even maybe the Cardinals, some teams like that. I mentioned the Giants at one point as well. So there are teams that are in there, but it seems like the Dodgers all along have kind of been the most likely, you know, team to make that trade. And then also the Dodgers did, you know, sign a Cuban infielder yesterday, a guy that's probably more, you know, is minor league deal, so it's not a big signing for the Dodgers, but you never know if that also puts a wrench in their plans as well. So at this point, it's still worth monitoring, but I do think it's going to resolve here pretty quickly.
All right. Well, as you referenced, Rhett, the pitching is a fundamental need for the Twins if they're going to have any hope of being a competitive ball club here moving forward. The rotation was a real mess again in 2016. You had an article recently on the Twins website about their rotation picture, and I thought we'd run through a couple of those guys just to get your thoughts on them. First of all, Kyle Gibson, he had a 5.07 ERA in 25 starts last year, and he might be the number two starter on this. What are your thoughts on Gibson going into the new year?
It's a big year for him. I thought last year was going to be his breakout year. He had a really good year 2 years ago. Maybe not really good, but a solid year by his standards. ERA in the low fours with a solid starting pitcher with a good sinker ball. Not really a strikeout guy, but certainly a good middle-to-back-end starter that you could count on. And sure enough, last year, it all kind of went haywire. He struggled with injuries a little bit too, kind of had a back injury throughout the year, went on the DL at one point as well, and just never really got consistent. I think that big step forward they're hoping he's going to take, especially with the strikeouts, never came. So I think this is a year for him. He's got to kind of prove that he can be a part of this rotation. Obviously, he was a big prospect for a long time. He's got the prototypical frame of being, 6'6", sinker baller. It's just that thing where the slider and the changeup really have never been that kind of outpitch, I think, they kind of wanted it to be. So it's certainly not too late. But this is definitely going to be a big year to kind of prove that he can at least even be a mid-rotation starter. Because last year, he was their second-best guy, but his ERA, like I said, was in the five. So it goes to show you just how, tough the rotation was for last year for the Twins.
Yeah, and it got tougher still. Hector Santiago arrived mid-season. There was some thought, well, that could be a good play there, a guy with some control attached to him. But then he had a 5.58 ERA and 11 starts for Minnesota. What's up with Santiago here moving forward?
Well, a lot of that was just kind of early on, though, too. I mean, he really came over and struggled right out of the gate. He was a lot better there down the stretch, just much better. Even at one point, when he first came over, he was on a hot streak with the Angels. I thought, okay, can he keep this going? Sure enough, went the other way, and he was so bad at it. I almost had to wonder if he was going to be a non-tender candidate, but then sure enough, turned it around there down the stretch. So I think they kind of know he's one of those guys that kind of walks that tightrope of walking a lot of guys, giving up home runs. But he's been effectively wild. I think his career ERA is right around 3.7, 3.8. So he's had a solid career. So I think it's one of those things where maybe last year when he first came over, it's kind of maybe just that, new team jitters, that kind of stuff, and working with a new pitching coach. But once he kind of got his mechanics and everything kind of ironed out a little bit, he was much better. So he's kind of a wild card going into this year. Like I said, he's just such a, erratic pitcher in some ways. You never know what you're going to get. But he's been an all-star before. He's a veteran, so he's definitely going to be a part of the rotation. Just at this point, it's going to be hard to really know what they're going to get from him.
Another trade acquisition, interesting name, Adalberto Mejia was acquired for Eduardo Nunez. Obviously, this is more in the prospect realm, Brett, but what are the chances of this guy cracking the opening day rotation? Do you think he could potentially fight his way into a job, or is he more on the back burner at this point?
It's certainly possible, but it would be surprising. I think that obviously a guy like Jose Berríos, who's been up there longer, has a better shot than he does, even though, as we've talked about a bunch, Berríos really obviously had a big struggle up there in the majors. But Like, he has a very quality left-handed arm there, a big guy. I was surprised how big he was in person when he came over. He pitched one game in Kansas City after the trade. Big, strong guy, lefty, good control. He was suspended, you know, I think it was 2 years ago for PEDs, I believe. But since then, has bounced back and had a really, you know, kind of regained his prospect status. So for me, and I still believe it, we'll see how he does in the majors. I think it was a solid trade for the Twins at the time to add a major league, you know, ready left-handed arm like that. I don't think, like I said, I think he's probably more likely to go to AAA throughout the year out, but I do think for sure he'll be in the rotation at some point this year.
All right, there you have it. The Rays from Rhett Bollinger. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.
MLB.TV Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.TV Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details.